The following is a sermon from Haven Heights Baptist Church in Wauseon. At Haven Heights, we believe that faith comes through hearing, and hearing through the Word of Christ. As you listen to the sermon, we pray the Lord would use the preaching of His Word to point you to Jesus and to strengthen your faith in Him. If you're looking for a church home, we'd love for you to join us on Sunday mornings at 10:30 a.m. For more information about our church, go to havenheightsbaptist.org or find us on Facebook. In our passage this morning, Jesus takes the bread, He breaks the bread, He hands the bread and the fish to His disciples, and the disciples pass out the five loaves and the two small fish to a crowd of over 5,000 people, and everyone eats. Everyone eats their fill. The food never runs out. It's a miracle. Now, Jesus does the miracle, and yet He does the miracle through the disciples. It was His power through them that caused the miracle. And this passage shows us that people like you and me can experience the power of God through us. We begin with the main idea. We can experience the power of God. That's what we're talking about this morning. We can experience the power of God. In order to do so, we need, number one, the right situation. Number two, we need to surrender. Number three, we need spiritual sight. So first, to experience the power of God, we need the right situation. The right situation, the situation in which we can experience the power of God, is the situation in which we are unable to provide for ourselves. That's verse 2. A great crowd is following Jesus and they're hungry. The crowd's in the wilderness. There's no place to get food. Their situation is the perfect scenario for disaster. Here's what happened. Jesus' ministry is going great. It's growing in popularity. And so many people are following Him that Jesus decides that we're just going to need to take a break. There's just too many people. We've been ministering too long. And so Jesus tells His disciples, we're going to get into a boat. We're going to go to the other side of the sea. We're going to get alone and we're going to take a break. And so Jesus gets in the boat and He travels across the Sea of Tiberias, and the crowd decides, we are going to walk around to meet Him on the other side. Now, depending on where they're at, Jesus crosses the sea, travels at least a mile, maybe more, and wherever the crowd is at, they're going to have to travel at least twice as far to meet Him. So that's verse 1. Jesus gets to the other side of the lake. Verse 2, a great crowd has amassed. Jesus gets off the boat and the crowds run up to Him. Verse 10, it's 5,000 men. When women and children are accounted for, the crowd is upwards of 20,000 people. And person after person comes running up to Jesus, and hour after hour, Jesus ministers to them. And this appears to be just the greatest thing in the world. But it's dangerous. The crowd's a long way from home. The closest town's over 10 miles away. It's late into the day. The crowd can't go home. They're too tired. They've been walking or running or standing all day. They're in the wilderness. No McDonald's, no food, only danger. Some of us may remember Woodstock. And if you don't know, Woodstock was a music festival held outdoors in a field, and the festival just sort of blew up. The crowd that came was over 10 times the amount anticipated. And because the crowd was so large and so unexpected, there was no preparation. There wasn't enough food. There wasn't enough water. There wasn't enough medical facilities. The crowd was so large and so unexpected that it's amazing only 3 people died. Thousands of people gathered in a field without supplies, and people died. That's what's happening here. It's a dangerous scene. If Jesus doesn't do something quickly, people are going to get hurt and probably die. And so Jesus calls His disciples together. And the Lord asks Philip, where should we buy bread for all these people to eat? And Philip says, well, even if we could buy bread, and I don't think that we can buy bread, but if we could buy bread, verse 7, it's going to take more than half a year's wage to even do this. Jesus, we can't do anything about this. We can't get food. And if we could find it, we don't have enough money, we're powerless. And in the situation in which we're powerless, that's the situation in which Jesus can do something. The situation in which Jesus can do something is a situation in which we realize I can do nothing. Now, didn't they already realize that? Didn't they already realize that they needed Jesus? Think of the crowd here. They clearly make no provisions for their journey. They're so desperate to see Jesus that they run for miles around the lake. They throw all caution to the wind. There's only one thing on their mind. I have to get to Jesus because he's the only one that can help me. It seems as though they already know that they need Jesus. But here's the thing. Before Jesus feeds them, they already got what they came for. They came for healing and Jesus healed them. They came for wisdom and Jesus spoke to them. And isn't it true that when we get from the Lord what we want, we easily forget that we need him? Years ago, I was meeting with a couple for marriage counseling, and they had the number one typical problem: disagreement about money. And he said to me, he was very candid, he said, you know, if I just made more money, I think most of our marriage problems would go away. And I said, well, maybe, but the problem might be more than just physical. You know, there probably is a physical problem here that you probably do need more money coming in, and yet there's also a spiritual problem, and the Lord wants you to see that you still need him. So we met for a few weeks, and we talked about the Lord, and every time we asked the Lord to provide for their need, and sure enough, the Lord answered their prayer. And the Lord gave him a new job, a high-paying job, and it was immediate, and it was incredible. And just a few weeks, the Lord provided a new job. And nearly just as immediate, and nearly just as incredible, the man decided, we no longer need to meet to talk about the Lord. That's how John 6 could have gone. Jesus healed them. Jesus counseled them. They got what they wanted. And they would have walked away. And we know with certainty they would have walked away because at the end of the chapter, they do walk away. Jesus knows, I gave you what you wanted. You've now got one foot out the door. And so I'm going to create a situation in which you can't leave. He led them into the wilderness. He kept them for hours on end, just waiting for them to become hungry. Dangerously hungry, creating the situation for them to see that they still need him. And this is what he does. He creates for all of us a situation in which we realize, I need him. The year is 2025. We live in the United States of America, the most blessed people who ever were. Not one of us is going to live John chapter 6 this afternoon. None of us are going to go home and say, I don't know if I'm going to have enough food to eat. In fact, we're all going to go home. And we're all going to sleep in our bed tonight. We are a people who have our every single need met. And it's all the Lord's kindness. And the temptation is strong to say, because I have what I need from the Lord, I don't know how much I need the Lord. And because that temptation is so strong, sometimes the Lord brings trial, sometimes trauma, sometimes temptation. But most often the situation is low-key letdown. Most of us experienced that situation just a week ago at Christmas. And for most of us, the buildup is always better than the day. We build up Christmas in our minds and we can't wait to give the gift and to see the expression on their face. Or we can't wait to get the gift. We can't wait to see our loved ones. And even when it goes perfect to plan, there's the letdown. And we say, that was good, but it wasn't as good as expected. It's not just Christmas, it's the man who wakes up one day and asks the question, what am I doing? And he looks at his family, looks at his house, he looks at his car, he says, you know, I have all of this stuff, but it's not enough. I'm not fulfilled. It's the mom who works tirelessly for her children. She has great kids. She has the kids that everyone wants. And then one day she realizes, I'm powerless over their life. It's the couple who saved for retirement, amassing more than enough money, and then they realize, I have nothing to spend it on. And it's all the same. Jesus creates a situation in our life where we see, although he's met every single need of mine, I still need him. That's the situation. Jesus has met their every need, and he wants them to see afresh, you still need me. And so he asks the disciples, can you provide food? Philip says, no, we can't do that. Jesus asks, just out in the blue, can anyone provide food? And Andrew says, well, there's a little boy over here, and he's got something. Verse 8, he's got 5 loaves and 2 small fish, but that's nothing. And with that, the situation is obvious. No one has power to do anything except for Jesus. Number 2, in order to experience the power of God, we need to surrender. Andrew tells Jesus, there's food over here. This little boy, he's got 5 loaves and 2 small fish, but it's not really enough. And then Jesus says, go take it from him. Now suppose you're that little boy, and you've got your dinner all out in front of you, and you've got all your loaves lined up, and you've got your 2 fish lined up, and you're ready to eat. And then the disciples come over, and they say, Jesus, I'm so sorry, but Jesus, you know the guy up there, he wants to take your dinner. One of the things about Woodstock that caused people to remember it with such fondness is that people shared everything. The people who talk about Woodstock, even years later, they talk about sharing blankets and sharing water bottles and sharing food, and they say it was amazing. They say people seem to genuinely love their neighbor. And they said, you know, it was so beautiful that it brought tears to their eyes just seeing people care for one another. That type of thinking has led many liberal theologians to conclude that the miracle of the story is not that Jesus multiplied the bread and the fish. The miracle of the story is that the boy shared his dinner. The miracle is that the boy surrendered his food out of love for neighbor. And they say when the boy surrendered his dinner, that probably caused all the others to get out what little food they had, and they began to share their food. And because giving is better than receiving, they felt full on the inside. And because everyone was cared for, they felt as though they had more than enough. Now that's hardly what's going on here. This account is clearly a miracle. To see this account as example or hyperbole, to see it as anything other than a factual account of a miracle, just does violence to what the text actually says. Liberal theologians get it wrong, but they get one thing right. They rightly understand how important it is that the boy surrendered. And sometimes in our defense of the miracle, we just gloss right over the surrender. And sometimes we forget that the miracle only happens after the surrender. And that's the way that it always works. God's power only comes after we surrender. Now, it's not only the boy who surrenders. They all must surrender. Look at verse 10. Jesus says, have the people sit down. And from the other Gospels, we know this is an incredibly orderly account. So Jesus tells them, have them sit down in groups of hundreds and fifties. It's like, get organized, get prepared. It's like dinner time at the wise household. We say, boys, wash your hands and come sit down for dinner. Get organized. We're about to eat. That's what Jesus does. And then he does what we do. Verse 11, he gives thanks. And so don't miss what's happening here. Jesus prepares them for the food. He prays over the food, but there is no food. The only food is 5 loaves and 2 small fish. He calls them to a banquet without the most important part of the banquet, food. And that requires an act of surrender. When the crowd sits down, they have to surrender natural reason for supernatural faith. If the Lord doesn't come through for them, they're going to be worse off. There's other people, and they're going to mock them. They're going to make fun of them. They're saying, look at you. You're an idiot. You followed this Jesus guy for nothing. And now all you've done is wasted more time? Now what are you going to do? Oh, that's right. You're sunk. You're in the middle of nowhere with nothing. Maybe not even the ability to get home. The boy surrendered his lunch. The crowd surrendered their pride. They all surrendered. And church, most assuredly, this is what the Lord is asking for each one of us. And we know he's asking us to surrender because that's the definition of being a Christian. To be a follower of Christ, to say, all I have is yours. And then to realize, because I gave it all to him, if he doesn't come through for me, I'm sunk. I gave him everything. And if he doesn't do something, I've got nothing. That's what it means to be a Christ follower. I give him everything. And if he doesn't do something, I have nothing. Now let's be honest for a minute. Sometimes we don't surrender. And we don't surrender because we think if I literally give him everything, I'm probably going to be left with nothing. And we say, you know, it's just too hard to control my tongue. It's just too hard not to curse at work. It's too hard to return kindness for insult. And we think, I'm going to have to hold back in order to get ahead. We say it's too hard to live in purity. It's too hard not to look at pornography. It's too hard to live a chaste life in my relationship. We think, if I'm ever going to be satisfied, I'm going to have to hold back. We say it's not possible to be generous. It's too hard to give money to the Lord's work. It's too hard to give my time to the Lord's people. We think, if I'm ever going to be any good at home, I'm going to have to hold back. And when we say I'm going to have to hold back, when we say I will not surrender, we are saying Jesus does not have the power to replace what I give up. If I give up, I'm going to be worse off because he doesn't have the power. He can't have it, and so I'm going to hold it. And when we refuse to surrender, what we are actually doing is surrendering the opportunity to experience his power. When we refuse to surrender, we surrender the opportunity to experience his power. Number three. In order to experience the power of God, we need spiritual sight. There may be some among us this morning who don't experience the power of God because we don't have spiritual eyes to see. And sometimes we get sick, and sometimes we suffer, and we demand to know, why is God doing this? This is what the Apostle Paul is doing. Paul is ranting and raving, God, I can't serve you like this. You got to take this thorn away from me. Why can't you see when I have this thorn, I'm no good to you? Take it away, heal me, so I can do things for you. And God says to him, "My power is made perfect in your weakness." God says, "Paul, don't you see it? Don't you have eyes to see? I'm not against you, but for you. And I've allowed the thorn so that you can see my power in you." That's what we see in this passage. Jesus leads them into the wilderness. He goes up on the mountain. Has them just wait, down at the foot of the mountain, just wait for hours. Leads them to the point of desperation and danger. And not because he's against them, but because he is for them. Look at verse 6. He already had in mind what he was going to do. Jesus leads them to the place of danger, not by accident, but by intention, so that they might see his power. And that's exactly what happened. They saw the power of God. They saw God provide for them. They ate and they ate and they ate and they ate to the point of satisfaction. And there was more than enough left over. Verse 13, Jesus sends the disciples out and they pick up 12 basketfuls. And they see it. They see the power of God for them. They experienced his power. He's unlimited, unending, more than enough, abundant power. And so we ask, where is that now? If we're honest, we hear sermons like this, and we say, well, that's great. That's great for them. And I see it in John chapter 6, but I don't see it here. Why don't I get to see power like that? Why don't I get to see things like that in my life? Where is his power for me? So many times we don't see his power because his power is quiet. His power is quiet and regularly goes unnoticed. Now imagine you're in the crowd. And imagine the basket is passed and the basket comes to you. And you put your hand in and you scoop out the bread and the fish. And you put it before you begin to eat. And there's nothing noisy about that. That's quiet, normal stuff. You reach in the food basket, and you pull out your dinner, and you've done that hundreds of times, maybe thousands of times. In the moment, it's just normal. For those in the crowd, pulling out the food was nearly unnoticeable in terms of God's power. And that's more in line with what we experience. In the moment, his power in our life is nearly unnoticeable and often goes unnoticed unless we have spiritual eyes to see. And for those with eyes to see, this is what it looks like. It looks like calmness. Jesus has a calmness about him. Close to the end of his life, he's standing before Pilate. And Pilate looks at Jesus eye to eye, and Pilate says, "You know I can kill you." And Jesus is calm and controlled. Because Jesus knows the only power Pilate has is from God. And Jesus knows that God's power is always for him. And God's power causes Jesus to remain calm and controlled even when his life hangs in the balance. God's power looks like perseverance and faith. Abraham believed God's promise. God told Abraham, I'm going to give you a son. And Abraham is old and his wife is old. And yet day after day for over 25 years, Abraham believes that God will provide for him. And Abraham looks at the sun and he looks at the moon and he knows that God's power put those into place. And he says that power that created that can create a life inside of Sarah. God's power causes Abraham's perseverance and faith. God's power looks like conviction and courage. Moses tells Pharaoh over and over again, let my people go. And every single time, Pharaoh says no. And every time, Moses says, you better be careful because I've seen the power of God. God's power causes Moses to be a man of conviction and courage despite any and all opposition. And we could talk of Jacob. We could talk of David, we could talk of Job, we could talk of Gideon, and we could have talk of countless more, and it's all the same. God's power working through his people. And it always looks the same. Mostly ordinary. It's joy and sorrow. It's love for enemy. It's peace and trouble. It's patience and suffering. It's holiness and temptation. It's kindness for insult. And on the surface, it looks ordinary, but it never is. It's the power of God. And this morning, every Christ follower here is longing to see the power of God in us. And so what are we to do? We end with three very practical things. How do we experience his power? Three things. Number one, believe that God wants you to experience his power. Believe that he wants his power to flow through you. Isaiah 30, verse 18. The Lord longs to be gracious to you. Believe it. Believe that he wants you to experience his power. And if you don't believe that he is for you, you cannot experience his power. Number two, surrender to God. Surrender. Hold nothing back. Do everything that God says and trust that he is better than anything we're tempted to hold on to. And if we do not surrender, we will not experience his power. Number three, see what God will do. And that means wait. We have to wait for God to reveal his power in us, in his time, and in his way. And if we do not wait long enough, we will not see his power. That's it. To experience the power of God in your life, three things. Believe that he's for you, surrender to him, and wait. Do these things, and every single one of us will experience his power. You've been listening to a sermon from Haven Heights Baptist Church in Wauseon. If you're looking for a church home, we invite you to join us. We gather on Sunday mornings at 10:30 a.m., For more information about our church, go to havenheightsbaptist.org or find us on Facebook.